Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Cillian Murphy chats about his fantastic new film, Steve, where he plays a head teacher in a tough reform school. I also talk to the film's writer, Max Porter. Tom Dunn tells me why Spinal Tap 2 hits the mark for rockers and non-rockers alike. Plus, we review A Big, Bold, Beautiful Adventure starring Colin Farrell and Margot Robbie. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app, powered by Go Loud, or wherever you get your podcasts, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all, and I do hope you're doing well. I wasn't so well this week. I finally gave in to a cold that had been brewing for a long, long time. I'm on the mend now, but I was really wiped. There's a lot of people sick this week in my wider world. I think it's changing seasons. People come back to school. Who knows? But, you know, in our house, we're always up before the kids and we're always in bed after the kids. They never see us sleeping. You know, and you might wonder why I'm telling you that, but my daughter was telling everyone, Daddy was in bed a lot this week, which isn't a great look, but I was floored, but I'm on the mend. And sure, why wouldn't I be when I'm talking to the likes of Cillian Murphy and Tom Dunn and all sorts of other people? I do hope you're well, and thank you for everyone who got in touch last week. Don't forget, you can email screentime@newstalk.com. Now for the week that's in it, I simply have to start the show with this.
I'm sorry. I know that means little at this point, but I am. I tried. I think you would all agree that I tried. To be true. To be strong. To be kind. To love. To be right. But I wasn't.
Yeah, no, that was a clip of the now sadly deceased Robert Redford. Hopefully you haven't heard that clip. A lot of people were playing, you know, things from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and All the President's Men and even The Sting and The Way We Were. Rightly so. Those are great, great movies. I wanted to bring you that because that's from his 2013 movie, All Is Lost, where I think he, on last count, he only had 51 words of dialogue. He's this sea captain lost at sea, looking back on his life. An Oscar snub, many felt, myself included, because it was a brilliant role. But look, that was part of the brilliant career of Robert Redford. You know, what I always liked about his career is that he was undeniably handsome and charismatic to look at, and you would follow him into battle. And yet he made some, you know, unexpected choices. He was a real actor's actor. You know, he was in things like The Way We Were, which were light, wonderful movies, but he did brilliant things like All the President's Men and, of course, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which he wasn't going to be in, but Paul Newman talked the powers that be in because he was a bigger star at the time. The Sting is a terrific movie. He was also a brilliant director, and his first directorial debut, maybe the greatest directorial debut of an actor ever, a movie called Ordinary People, about a family getting over a tragedy. It is absolutely brilliant with Donald Sutherland. A fantastic film, and it was incredible at the time. That was the first movie he directed. He also, you know, did things in later life, like showing up in Indecent Proposal, where he was going to give Demi Moore all sorts of money to go to bed with him, and Woody Harrelson was the possibly cuckolded husband. He was just brilliant. He was never bad in anything. And of course, he set up the Sundance Foundation, which gave us one of the greatest film festivals and maybe the most important one of the last 50 years in the form of the Sundance Film Festival, and brought independent cinema back into the mainstream. He is a huge loss, and he was a brilliant actor, you know, Hollywood royalty, but also a guy who cared deeply about movies, films, and how they were made and how they were seen. So if you had to do, see, I can't keep it to three. So I would say Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The Sting, All the President's Men, but I'd also have to put in Ordinary People that he directed, and you'd have to finish it out with All Is Lost, which he was in 2013. So anyway, a brilliant actor, RIP the great Robert Redford. Now, En route to Cillian Murphy, I want to tell you about TV that I was watching this week. You may know this is a good few weeks old, out on Sky, The Paper, which has a very interesting premise because it is the documentary, well, the mockumentary team behind the US office, which ran for 9 or 10 seasons, following on the UK office, but the US office with Steve Carell, which ended 10 years ago at this stage, where they followed a paper company in Northwest America around Dunder and Mifflin. That documentary crew are back this time, and there's small kind of crossovers between The Office and this new series, but not really. There's a few little things and a few little Easter eggs. One or two cast members, maybe. I won't say much more than that. But this documentary crew now decamp to a floundering local newspaper called the Toledo Truth Teller. And it's a newspaper that is in disarray and they don't really print any kind of proper news. Donal Gleason, being very American, comes in as a plucky new editor, Ned Sampson, and he hasn't been a newspaper guy before. He was actually selling toilet roll and cardboard. He's going to try and work miracles at this newspaper. So that's kind of the setup. Here's the thing, folks. I was slightly disappointed by this. And you know, I get no joy out of kicking anything, really. But I thought this was going to be funnier, given the people involved. Now, Donald Gleason isn't bad in it, but it's just not funny enough. There's probably just a kind of one idea to it, this idea of this bad newspaper trying to become a proper journalistic enterprise and some of the funny people who were writing for it and stuff like that. But there just wasn't enough to it. I smiled plenty of times, but I remember about 3 episodes in turning to my wife last week saying, this isn't as funny as I thought it was going to be. So it's fine, but I was kind of disappointed because I was expecting a lot more. But look, do let me know if you might have been watching The Paper on Sky. Not to be confused with the Michael Keaton movie from the 90s, which is a lovely kind of cult watch all about a newspaper man trying to get a newspaper out. But I digress. The Paper on Sky, it's only so-so, I'm sorry to say. But do let me know what you are thinking of it if you happen to be watching it. ScreenTime@newstalk.com. Now take a listen to this.
Try and get them in a room together. Riley needs an intervention, Stephen. Fuck's sake, never called Nabil's dad. Okay, 4. Call Nabs's dad. Basically, Stephen, basically, deal with it. Get through the day. You're 48 years old. This is what human beings do. You're an adult human being.
Yes, you heard Cillian Murphy there playing Steve, talking to himself into a dictaphone. Yes, it's in the 90s, 1996 to be precise. This is Cillian Murphy playing Steve, who is the head of a reform school set in kind of the countryside in England. And it's housed by children, young adults who, and it's housed by young adults who society has forgot. And Steve is a hands-on head teacher there, trying his best with these kind of last chance students. And when we meet him, there's a documentary crew coming to film him. One of the students in particular is a guy called Shaw, you heard referenced it there, played by Jay Lacurgo, a very troubled teen. And lots of the teens in this are very troubled. This is a brilliant watch. You have Cillian Murphy attempting to keep this school together, and the outside world is weighing on him, and some of his own life is weighing on him. He's brilliant in it. There's a lot of close-ups in it, and some of the drama is nearly carried in his face. It was written by a guy called Max Porter, because he wrote a book called Shy a number of years ago, all about this aforementioned student. And in this movie version, where he turns his novel into a movie, he focuses more on the teacher, or the teacher alongside the students in this. Max Porter wrote a hugely selling novel a couple of years ago called Grief is a Thing with Feathers, which Cillian Murphy acted in his play version of it. So Max Porter knows how to write a script or two. Steve is in cinemas this weekend and will be for 2 weeks before it moves to Netflix in 2 weeks' time on October 3rd, which would lead you to believe that they are hoping this will be an awards contention. And you can see why, given the writing, given Cillian Murphy's performance. So I got to talk to Max Porter, who, as I say, is the writer of Steve and who wrote the novel it's based on, and also Cillian Murphy. Now, Cillian Murphy needs no introduction, so I'm not going to give him one. Here's Max Porter and Cillian Murphy.
Hi, John.
Hey, guys, how are you? Congratulations. It's a terrific watch. Killian, the movie starts and there's this close-up of you, and it's quite a dramatic one, and there's a lot of close-ups of you throughout it, and sometimes part of the story is nearly carried in your face and your expression. And I'm wondering, is it a particular skill when the camera is that close to you for so much of the movie, or is it just like any other acting gig?
It's a very long process. The trying to learn how to be comfortable when you got loads of cameras pointed at you, and it's something that takes an awful lot of time, and it's something that you have to keep working at constantly. It never becomes second nature. It's always something you have to work at. That's why I keep re-collaborating with the same people, because that makes it easier when you're in a room where you really, really trust people, and it's a highly unnatural way to make work, but it's the only way you can, mix the kind of purely creative and emotional with the highly technical. You have to be in a state of ease, and you have to feel protected and safe. And if you have your close friends and collaborators working with you, then it's easier to access that.
Okay, fascinating. Max, most of us went to school and we had teachers. Some of us, like myself, have kids and we see teachers, and the bad ones can stay with you a lifetime and the good ones the same thing, And I gather your changing of your novel to the perspective of a teacher in this, you see it as almost a kind of a love letter or a thank you to the teachers of the world, or is that a gross approximation?
No, I mean, and certainly now we're showing it to people, that appears to be how it's being received, which means the world to us. We love that. I would say yes, in its specifics, definitely to teachers in the midst of, or as the victims of, a systemic collapse, a systemic crisis, be it of funding or faith or individual circumstance. But I would just broaden it out wherever possible to any delivery of care, the decision that human beings have made in whatever context to do hard, difficult work that has both immediate results, climbing Jamie down from wanting to smash Riley in the face is an immediate fix, but longer term, these kind of people, be them midwives, therapists, foster parents, council workers, volunteers in an organization, whatever, they have an inherent faith that you are planting a seed, the fruits of which you will never enjoy yourself. So it is almost a pure distillation of the human faith in one another and in the ripple effect of any kind of compassionate gesture. So yeah, I hope people can read it more ambiently or more broadly as just a love letter to hard, good work.
Yeah, people who do good things. Yeah. Killian, and I gather your own father was, Max might not know this term, but a kiggerer. I remember being in school and the idea of the school inspector was a terrifying prospect. And our own teachers used to get very animated about a kiggerer coming. When you were young, did you have a sense that's a strange job my dad has as a kiggerer? He breeds fear into people.
It's funny you say that, because whenever I am on the radio having conversations like this, and sometimes people call in or send in texts or...
Yeah. Oh, yes. I know all about it.
I'm sure that's your... Well, inevitably when I am, there's always a number of texts from teachers who my dad came to visit as the Kigger's Gullah, and they're always really, really warm... and thankful for how he was in the classroom. And it's lovely for me to hear that, because I definitely completely underestimated how seriously my mum and my dad took their work. And other ex-pupils of my mum will come up and talk to me about my mum teaching French to them. And so when you feel that, when you get that response firsthand, it's quite emotional, because our parents were there to answer our questions, like wash our clothes, drive us to school, give us money, and all of that. And but you, as you get older, have your own kids, you begin to figure it out. And I really am, I'm very proud of what they did when we were growing up and what they're still doing.
Yeah. Max, you know, it's firmly 1996 that this is set in. Why then?
Well, partly because it occurred to me that the 90s were kind of coming back around and we were asking ourselves interesting questions about that time, particularly in Britain, you know, with the end of one appalling reign of conservative destruction as we ended another. You know, when I was writing this, it was the end of the Boris Johnson years, which, you know, I think we can all agree on a global scale were a catastrophe both for the body politic and for the human spirit. Hi, Boris, if you're listening. See you in prison. But also, what were the, you know, the Blair years, the kind of cool Britannia thing? What was that actually like to live in? For a lot of people, not at all cool, not cool at all. And decisions were being made then about the dismantling of the social care system, which we're feeling the reverberations of now. Plus the music, you know, Killian and I, music is a really important part of our friendship and our love of the both of our different parts of the culture industry. And I wanted to write a film about someone who loves music so much it might actually even save their life. And that was just a straightforward aim for me. And pre-phones, pre-social media, you know, the whole presentation of the self has undergone a major change. So I liked setting it before all that, but somehow showing us a little bit what that's like for us now.
Fascinating. Killian, I saw the latest cover of Sight and Sound. I didn't buy it, unfortunately, but it has this thing. You're on the front of it. You're probably aware because you did the interview. And it said, I'm not that interested in doing the lighter side of storytelling, you know? Yeah. And I was thinking, this sounds like a very strange thing considering you've won Oscars, but one of my favorite lines of yours is Intermission, where you say to Michael McElhattan, I'm going to crack the baldy head off you. I only watched the clip this morning and I was laughing again. But do you think, it seems like a strange question when we're talking about Steve, which is a brilliant piece of serious work, but are there comedies in your future? Because I think you have a facility for that as well. Not that you need me to tell you about your talents.
Well, that's the problem with headlines, though, isn't it? They're by their nature reductive. But I've done an awful lot of like comedy on stage with Enda Walsh, and like Intermission is a good example. You know, it was very funny, but again, their lives were falling apart, all of them, left, right, and center. And that's the brilliance of Irish writing, is that we're so good at that. And what I don't mean by that. You know, I'm not going to ever be in a... What I'm trying to say is that I'm really interested in the human struggle and how difficult it is for all of us, particularly nowadays. You can still find humour in that. It can still be black humour. You can still have pratfalls and physical comedy, and I'm all down for that. I'm just not into perfectly formed, infallible, untouchable lives, because that to me is a fantasy, and that's not what I want to talk about.
Very much so. And Steve is funny in places as well, it's important to say, and it's a terrific watch, and lovely to talk to you both, and continued success.
Thanks, man. Nice to chat.
Killian Murphy and Max Porter there talking to me about Steve, which is now in cinemas and will be on Netflix on the 3rd of October. And it was great to talk to Killian. I never got to talk before. I was due to for Oppenheimer, and then there was a writer's strike literally the day I was washing my face thinking about the interview, and I got a call as I was leaving the house. Anyway, it's a pretty dull story, isn't it? What isn't dull is Steve. It is a great watch, so do check it out in the cinema or on Netflix in 2 weeks' time. Up next, Tom Dunn gives us the skinny on the new Spinal Tap movie. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now, it was very remiss of me last week. We were kind of drowning in Downton Abbey and we missed a very important new release, the prequel of which we mentioned many times on this show. I'm talking about Spinal Tap 2, The End Continues. Finally, the sequel to the beloved mockumentary from back in 1984. Legendary fro rocker Spinal Tap with Christopher Guest, Michael McKean and Harry Harry Shearer, who are, of course, Nigel Tufnell, David St. Hubbins, and basic Derek Small, return for a cameo-studded rock sequel, or a mocu-sequel, if you will. A man who's no stranger to putting a German sausage down his leather pants is our very own Tom Dunn, who has, of course, seen it, and I'm delighted to say he joins me now. Tom, hello, sir.
Thank you very much. I can't believe you mentioned the German sausage this quickly in the interview, John. Our secret was safe, I thought.
Listen, obviously you're a music man, right? It's fair to say that Spinal Tap, for musicians, as well as the general public, though, it's kind of become its own verb or adjective. Like, I mean, Spinal Tap is the thing you think of when you're making possibly a wrong pop music or rock move, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It's like a rite of passage with bands. I think any new band has to kind of all watch it together. And there's just various moments along your life where you live through moments from it. And I think that's when it was released. That was what was part initially of the problem for the heavy metal community in particular. A lot of them people, Ozzy Osbourne, they claim, said he was in a cinema watching it and he was the only one not laughing. Yeah. Steven Tyler said, they're just holding up a mirror to our dumbest mistakes, you know. So, and apparently the band that it's really based on are Uriah Heep.
Right.
They were absolutely apoplectic about it and thinking, what's funny about this and how dare they? Because it is just, you know, if you're basing a business in an industry where there are far-breathing skulls, and men, you know, with the mental age of you know, teenage boys going on stage with egos and people who've never had any kind of responsibility in their life, who are brought to airports, put onto stages, of course it's going to be comic at best. So there was all that. But, you know, with the fullness of time, it was so beautifully observed. And yeah, there's never a moment. And particularly, I find it to this day, the one big one that still occurs is the backstage catering. And if you find yourself a part of anything where people want to impress you, they seem to try and use the backstage catering as where they will impress you. And sometimes you can do a big-ish gig and walk in and just see the most ridiculous things laid out for you. Wine and beer and whiskey and tequilas and crisps and sandwiches and all different sorts of meats. And you just go, what are we doing? Are we just doing a gig? You know, what? Or are we having a meal? What's the story?
So, and the purple M&Ms. So listen, Spinal Tap, beloved by musicians, but beloved by all sorts of people as well. I remember Patrick MacDonald, the comedian who plays Owen McLove and Father Ted, saying when there was a certain year when he was a teenager, his parents were worried about him because he was watching his VHS copy every day. Like, people just love that movie. So it's with, you know, a certain tentativeness, the idea of a sequel. So what's going on in this one? They're kind of getting the band back together, right?
Yeah, I don't want to ruin it for people because the various worlds they inhabit post-Tap are absolutely hilarious. So that's, you know, a huge part of the joke is seeing where it has gone to now. But we're about, I think, 15 years or so kind of on. And there's been what they would say is a big, you know, stick has been put between the spokes of the Spinal Tap bicycle. And it's something has happened in Spinal Tap world. But then the manager, Ian, sadly has passed away. But in his will, he's kind of left the band to his daughter, and his daughter has one. There's still a contractual obligation in Ian's will for the band to do one more gig. So the band have to get back together to do a gig to fulfill the terms of this will. So they're being assembled very much against their will to do one more gig. And that's the world that we're put into. And then it picks up the story of where they've been, what they've been up to is just sensational. And a thing I loved too about it is that if the first world was the heavy metal world, this is a much more realistic world of the world today, where bands have to, they call it juggling their portfolio, which really means working in a part-time job when you're not in the band. And and that's the world of the musician these days. There's no getting around that fact. Everything has changed. CDs don't sell. You do as many gigs as you can. You have to be on social media. You have to promote yourself. You don't get any money from streaming. All of these things. So it's in that world now. It's obviously much more realistic. But what I found so beautiful about it is that the chemistry between the three leads is just absolutely gorgeous. And they've kind of leaned into the fact that they're not as young as they used to be. You could argue that they were never that young, really. But you know, they're creaky and groany and make noises getting up. You know, it's forgetting lyrics and, you know, they're getting lost in their own homes at this point. So, and that's just done absolutely beautifully. And then Marty, he doesn't seem like he's aged at all. He's still trying to get the truth from them. They're kind of very mistrustful of him after what he did with the first movie where he made them look foolish, which they weren't expecting. So you have all that. And then around that world, there's the modern bits. I don't want to reveal anything about, but obviously a band that's had 12 drummers and has lost all of them. You know, that's going to be a hard position to fill.
Yeah.
So the tale of trying to fill that is beautifully observed. That brings them up in contact with kind of the modern world of music, which is brilliant too. The guest appearances too.
Cameos are off the charts by all accounts.
I was expecting them just to be a kind of very passing thing, but they're not at all. The two main ones, Paul McCartney and Elton John, they have real parts to play in this. And they play them, particularly McCartney. And I don't want to ruin it, but when he gets involved with them, it's just, once again, it's like being with a band in a room. And it's just one of them this time is Paul McCartney. But all the usual things are still at play, egos and disagreements. And it's just wonderful to see. The songs are amazing. And it does kind of play to its greatest hits a bit. So it does revisit moments from the first film, which are just brilliant. And the songs, the really great songs are still the older songs. It's still Listen to What the Flower People Say and Stonehenge as well.
Oh, and, excellent.
Did you know that Stonehenge is actually based on a true thing regarding Black Sabbath? In a later incarnation of Black Sabbath, when Ian Gillan was the singer, they had an album called Born Again, and it was all darkly mystical imagery on the cover of it. So the designer looked at it and said, I like this. I can work with this. So he made sketches, and before you could say, is this practical, they had produced a 20-foot fiberglass and styrofoam replica of the Stonehenge monument. So Black Sabbath were supposed to tour with that, but they weren't. They weren't able to because it wouldn't fit on any of the stages. It didn't get to be used once in the entire tour. So Tap was only a year after that. Obviously it made it a smaller monument. So they're such great jokes.
And we have Rob Reiner back being the interviewer that they're very mistrustful of, who's bringing it all again. So he's doing the same kind of thing again, but they're very mistrusting of him this time.
They are, but they're also more than happy to get back into bed with them, which I think speaks volumes for musicians, full stop, you know. They will be shafted by record companies and Spotify, but the minute they stop getting shafted, they give out about that.
Yeah.
What's wrong with me? You're shafting the other people. What have I done wrong?
So, Kamir, this is then a big thumbs up for you. You seem to find it hilarious and pleasant.
And poignant as well. Really? There were moments that were just absolutely beautiful. And the chemistry between them is gorgeous. And they're all capable of the most stupid. They're all brilliant actors. They really are. And the moments where various things happen to them would bring a tear to a glass eye. The finale is just fantastically stupid. I loved every moment of it. It's never going to touch Spinal Tap 1.
Yeah.
But it's as loving, you know, a kind of a love letter, I think would be the phrase you might use, to it that you could possibly hope for.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, so stars-wise, out of 5, what are you going to say?
I'm going to give it a 4.
A 4, okay.
Yeah, I know you're probably, your system is probably, anything over 3 is kind of miraculous, is it?
Well, no, 4 is very healthy. We rarely go to 5. Yeah, no, 4 is good.
And would you say Tap 1 is 5?
Yeah, I would, because it's just taken on this life of its own now, you know, and you had people like Patrick MacDonald watching it every day for a year. I'd say
with Tap One, it's become part of the cultural landscape. It's like Father Ted. It's one of those films where you quote lines from.
Yeah.
To this day, there are moments when you say it goes to 11 or considerably more than minor. What's wrong with sexy? Boston, not a college town, you know. That's sensational. It's just never out of your life. I can't imagine the last 40 years without it, The Godfather, Jaws. You know, it's huge.
Okay. Huge. But overall, though, for someone who loved Spinal Tap 1 or whatever it's called, This is Spinal Tap, this was a very pleasing sequel. So
totally.
Tom Dunn is giving 4 stars to Spinal Tap 2. The end continues. And Tom, in a completely different, you couldn't get more, less Spinal Tap than you and Fíochna O'Brien on the road. Any upcoming gigs you'd like to share with us before you go?
Yeah, we're back in business. I think we're going to be in the Mermaid in Bray on the 18th of October. We're back for 2 nights in the Mermaid as well in end of November, end of December. And there are loads of dates. And my first solo date in a long time in Kells over the weekend. Looking forward to it.
Fantastic. And is that just you and a guitar?
No, it's me and the genius that is Alan Connor, because although I can play guitar, it's better if somebody else does.
Now we're getting Spinal Tap-ish. Tom Dunn is giving Spinal Tap 2 The End Continues 4 stars. You can hear him, of course, every evening on News Talk, Monday to Friday. Tom, thanks a million.
Thanks, John.
The thing that you guys had as kids, is that still there?
I'm in a band that constantly is breaking apart and coming back together.
But the more we retreat into the music, the nicer things become. Not to be profound or anything, and it would be a first time for me.
Stonehenge, 'tis a magical place, where the moon doth rise with a dragon's face. Stonehenge,
we are Spinal Tap!
We'll go back in time, to that mystic land.
What we need to do is secure your legacy. If during the gig, at least one, but ideally no more than 2 of you, were to die,
would you settle for a coma?
Oh, no, that's interesting.
You know?
That's a great bit of thinking outside, well, a literal box, I suppose,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah. A clip there from Spinal Tap 2, The End Continues. And that was, of course, Tom Dunn talking to me about how much he enjoyed it. Now, Spinal Tap was out last week, but I was very keen to cover it because it is adored. That certainly the first movie. I'm going to try and see Spinal Tap 2 this weekend if time allows. But talking of new releases this week, there is the new Colin Farrell Margot Robbie movie, A Big Bold Beautiful Journey. So we'll find out about that after the break. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now the big new movie release, or another big new movie of the release outside of Steve, is the new Colin Farrell, Margot Robbie movie you may be hearing about, called A Big Bold Beautiful Journey. People are saying Shades of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Delighted to be joined now by Kenneth Foran, making his debut on Screen Time. We're bleeding lots of new people in, you know. He's come off the bench. Ken, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Thanks for having me on.
So listen, what's going on here? Is it a rom-com? Is it a... what is it?
That's a good question. It's kind of like a rom-com, and maybe we'll get into it in a little bit. Maybe it's kind of a portent of where rom-coms are kind of heading now in the future. But basically what the story is we have Colin Farrell, who is kind of an average guy, much like people listening here will have hopes and dreams, and maybe sometimes they don't work out. And he's at the stage of his life now where he's a little bit disillusioned with where he is.
Okay.
He goes to a wedding and he meets Margot Robbie, who is in a similar kind of state. She's finding herself, you know, she can't really commit to relationships. And the kind of common theme between them is they can't really move on. They've kind of stopped growing, they've stopped progressing, and they're stuck in a bit of a rut.
So they're kind of two lost souls coming together.
Yes.
And are they both at the wedding without people?
Yes, okay, yes, right. Exactly. Yeah, yes, yeah. They both turn
telltale up. Sign.
Yes, and it seems like we're setting up for the quintessential meet-cute between these characters. They seem aligned, but because of all this baggage, the boundaries they've put up, it doesn't really end up kind of clicking, and they both kind of say their farewells and they go their separate ways. But earlier at the start of the film, Colin Farrell, he had to go get a car from this quite strange, it's a really strange car rental. They only sell, or they only rent two cars. They're Saturns and they're from the 90s, and he has to pick that. And then they kind of bully him into taking one with a GPS. But the GPS, it's more like Kit from Knight Rider. So it, it talks to him and it says, you know, he's going home from the wedding. He's a bit dejected and it kind of says, would you like to go on a big, bold, beautiful journey? And he says, yes. And it says, yeah, but do you really want to go? I want to hear it. I want to, you scream it. So he says, yes, yes, I want to go on a big, beautiful journey. And the first stop it takes him to is like a roadside diner. And who does he meet there? Margot Robbie, who's there by similar circumstance. And they decide to go on this journey together. Now, this film, it's a little bit abstract. And you may be thinking, so far it sounds like, you know, standard rom-com fodder. This is where it gets a little bit strange. So the first stop on their trip is they go to a field and there's a red door. And you look around, it's a door that leads to nothing. But when you open it and step inside, they step inside one of their memories. So the first memory they step into is Colin Farrell, and he was at a lighthouse in Canada, the antique lighthouse that's been restored and kept, and it had a kind of significant moment for them. Okay. And then they go from spot to spot, different memories. So there's another one where it's he goes to high school. It's Colin Farrell's high school, and when he's there, it's the day of the big musical, and he's the lead. But he doesn't mind that. He still remembers the words. What he's really afraid about was this was the night that he told a girl he loved her for the first time and she rejected him. And he's afraid of living through that. So we go from these different stops, and each kind of stop is some kind of significance or becomes significant.
In both their lives.
Yeah. So Margot Robbie, we go to hers. There's a like a museum that her and her mother used to go to. And then there's... Yeah, we visit like their childhood homes and, you know, maybe meet their parents or meet other significant people. So without giving it, you know, the whole thing away, but we go on this kind of trip with them. And it's really good. Read performances. Really amazing from both. The two. It's really a two-man kind of.
Have they chemistry?
I think so. And I was talking to some people about it today and they were asking, you know, is Colin Farrell a bit too old, you know, because he's well, I mean, when you hear the news of like what's it, the Wuthering Heights is gonna be coming out with Jacob Elordi and Margot Robbie, they were wondering, well, Colin Farrell, he's great, but he's not necessarily the it guy, you know, in Hollywood. And I think that's part of it is the age range, because there's this kind of theme of looking back through memories and stuff, you kind of need a bit of an older person in that role. Yeah. And I think the chemistry does work well. I think they have a laugh together, but the scenes, they challenge each other as well.
And the Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind comparison I get is because it's jumping around a lot to different aspects of their lives in the past.
Yeah, the memories, that's it. And that's what I mean, it's very abstract. I definitely think this is going to be one for like the theatre people. It felt like a stage play at times, and there was elements of... stage kind of performance, so it's really good. And what I meant, I mentioned earlier when I said this might be the kind of way rom-coms are going, it's, I think on the surface of it, it seems a bit simplistic. It seems like it might be your standard rom-com format. And even after I seen it, I'd heard a couple of people talking about it, and they said, oh, well, you know, the music was the best part, in kind of a derogatory way, but I think that's doing it a disservice. The music is really good, but I think if you look under the surface, it's actually a very clever, and there's a good bit of depth to it, because if you imagine your standard rom-com format, there's this idea of fate and this idea of destiny and this, you know, we're on the same plane, and they get off the plane and they have to share a cab, and there's only one room left in the hotel. In this, there's more of an element of choice. The idea that they might not have run into each other at the wedding.
Yeah.
Or even if they met, if they didn't choose to pursue or choose to put the work in, it could have very easily gone a different way. So I think it's a bit more, I think there's a bit more to it maybe than seems on the surface.
Yeah, okay, interesting. And your point about, you know, this may be the future of rom-coms, I guess we're seeing a bit more of this.
Like
there's the Andrew Garfield movie from earlier in the year. I forget the name of it now. We Live in Time, I think it's called.
Oh, yeah.
And a few like that where they're playing around with the concept of it. So maybe this is the...
Yeah, the one I was thinking was The Materialist.
Oh, of course.
Where that was
only a couple of months ago.
But when you compare these rom-coms that are coming out now to like the 2000s, you know, because especially The Materialist, when I went to, before going to see that, I go to the cinema a lot, and I was with my girlfriend and we seen the trailer and she said, oh, that looks like Hitch, you know, with Will Smith. And I knew a little bit about it and I was like, I don't think it's going to be like Hitch. And then we went to see it and she said, yeah, that was nothing like Hitch. So it's like they're worlds apart, but there's a bit of a, I don't know, there's a bit more depth. I don't know if it's just a matter of personal taste, but I really like the direction that they're moving in.
Yeah, and maybe the world's getting tired of the standard one. Tell me this, who directed this?
Kogo Nada, that's the one name.
Yeah, no, because it actually sounded to me like a Yorgos Lanthimos movie, who's in Colin Farrell movies, but I guess it isn't. And tell me this, we don't want to give any kind of spoiler, and I don't want to know if they end up together, any of that stuff, because that is a spoiler, but did it have a satisfying end? Let's just put it like that.
I think so. I was satisfied.
Okay.
But I got the sense that other people around me might not have been so. So I don't know if that's a satisfying answer, but I really enjoyed it.
Well, if you were satisfied, that's why you're here to tell me. Okay, so on this show, we do ask for a star rating out of 5. So what stars are you going to give A Big, Bold, Beautiful Journey, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 19th of September?
4 stars. I give 4.
4 stars.
Yeah.
Okay, high praise indeed. And you mentioned Colin Farrell, you know, you think he's the right kind of guy for this. Margot Robbie's also excellent in it.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, really good. That's actually, I'm glad you brought that up because it's interesting. I don't know if you noticed, is Irishness becoming cool or becoming much more marketable in Hollywood?
So he's not changing his accent.
He's not changing his accent.
Do they refer to his Irishness?
Yeah. It's mentioned in the story. He says, oh, my dad was Irish, but my mom's American, and we moved over. So it's kind of written in and makes sense. But Margot Robbie, who is Australian, has an American accent.
Oh,
and surely she's got the sway to kind of say, no, I'll just do it in my own voice.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Kerry Condon as well. Do you remember F1?
Yeah.
Kerry Condon did her own accent.
That's true. Yeah. So, well, look, hallelujah. Let's do it.
Oh, it's great. You know, but I was just wondering, you know.
But tell me this, just it's coming back to me though, but Margot Robbie is significantly younger than Colin Farrell, right?
A little bit. I looked this up. I think he's 49 and she's like 36.
Okay.
So
it's a 13 year age gap.
So it's a little bit.
Just to play devil's advocate though, I mean, it would probably be less marketable if the age gap was the other way.
Yes. I would definitely agree with that. If she was the older. It's funny, I was chatting with someone today and she kind of said, oh, because like you said, he's on the Late Late Show and they're doing all the press junkets and kind of noticing Colin Farrell is dyeing his hair and he's got the fake tan and stuff. And I don't know, is it just, I was saying, I think there's a fine line you have to play maybe in Hollywood where you want to be that mature, sexy man and not the older, distinguished gentleman, you know.
It's a fine line, all right. Yeah, it's one I'm really struggling with at the moment. But anyway, let's not get into that. So that is 4 stars for A Big, Bold, Beautiful Journey from Kenneth Doran, who makes his screen time debut. Kenneth, thanks a million.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Hi, David.
David, what are you doing?
Mr. Nelson.
You're late, come on.
No, you're dead.
What?
You're dead, I was at your funeral. It's 4 years from now. I mean, look, maybe I was wrong, but get your pancreas checked, will you? Soon.
I don't know what kind of pre-show routine you're doing here, but there's no time. The curtain's in half an hour, everyone.
Wait. Mr. Nelson, how old am I?
You're 15.
I'm 15.
Cool. How old am I?
I don't know, 40?
I'm going to kill you today. Got 4 years from now.
A clip there from A Big, Bold, Beautiful Journey, which is now in cinemas, and Kenneth Foran gave it 4 stars. Interesting what he said about kind of the changing nature of rom-coms and how audiences maybe want a little more than the traditional boy meets girl. Anyway, that is now in cinemas for your viewing pleasure. That's it for this week. Next week on the show, I'm going to be talking to the cast or some of the cast of the new Netflix series, The House of Guinness, all about the machinations of the House of Guinness, Guinness, of course, being the very popular stout. So all of that to come next week. And possibly, it's not confirmed yet, but I may be talking to Emma Thompson. Let's see. So tune in next week for all of that. In the meantime, I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, the News Talk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Get in touch with me at any stage. You can email us screentime@newstalk.com. Leave you with a little music from the movies. Intermission was on my mind. I mentioned it to Cillian Murphy earlier in the show. Colin Farrell was in it, of course. So I was watching some clips during the week, and I was reminded of its great opening song. So I will leave you with Out of Control by U2, used in Intermission, and wish you a happy remainder to your weekend.